to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Robert Fisk, who is the Middle East correspondent for the independent newspaper of Great Britain. He has lived in the Middle East for almost three decades and holds more British and international journalism awards than any other foreign correspondent. He's the author of Pity the Nation, A History of the Lebanon War, and most recently, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. Robert Fisk is visiting Berkeley to speak at a meeting of MECCA. MECCA is the Middle East Children's Alliance and is committed to protecting and advocating for the rights of all people, especially children. Mr. Fisk, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much.
Where were you born and raised?
At a town called Maidstone in Kent, southeast England, about 30 miles from London. My father was a local city accountant, borough treasurer. My mother was the daughter of local cafe owners. Mm-hmm. My dad came from the north of England, much older than my mother. He was a soldier in the First World War. My mum joined the RAF in the Second World War. My father was too old to fight. I was born in 46, just after the war was over.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, a lot. When I was 10, my father and mother took me on my first trip abroad, which was to France. And my father wanted to go back to the Somme and find the places where he'd fought and, of course, almost died. And to find the house which he spent his first night of peace in on November the 11th, 1918. He did find the house and he didn't walk in. He was too shy. I went back later with a film crew many, many years later mm-hmm. and knocked on the front door. And the granddaughter of the old lady who looked after him was still living there. So he introduced me to the history of the 20th century, the terrible 20th century. And I grew up as a little boy at home listening to the radio news, which my father would listen to every morning, which was usually about news of British colonial withdrawal, wars in Cyprus, Kenya, and Palestine. The constant trips went back to France. My father went back again and again to the Western Front, and he went to Ypres, and he went to Verdun, the colossal, terrible French-German battle. And by the time I went to school, I knew that the Archduke Ferdinand's assassination had begun the First World War. I knew that the Second World War began in 1939, that Germany invaded France in 1940. I'd listened to the speeches of Churchill. So my father's almost obsession with war, not in an unhealthy way, but certainly in quite sometimes a disturbing way. A huge picture of Churchill sitting in Downing Street, photograph, hung gloomily over our fireplace year after year. Only after he died, my mother asked if I thought it was cruel to take it down. I said, no, take it down. Put up a watercolour of a river in Kent, you know. And so, I became very interested in history. My father was fascinated by books and history.
So, but why didn't you become a historian? Instead.
Well, what do you think this book is here?
Yeah.
I'm doing my best. Look, as a journalist...
At a certain point, you decide to become a foreign correspondent.
Tell you what it was. Yeah. I think that if you're a foreign correspondent, you are a kind of historian. What made me become a journalist, at the age of 12, we had black and white television at home, and once a week it showed a movie. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time was boring plays and concerts you wouldn't want to listen to. And one afternoon on a Sunday, they showed Hitchcock's creaky mm-hmm. old, slightly humorous, paranoid movie, Foreign Correspondent, in which Joel McCrea plays an American reporter, Humphrey Haverstock, who is sent off from New York just before the beginning of the Second World War. And he uncovers the top Nazi agent in London, is chased by the Gestapo through Holland, witnesses a political assassination, is shot down by a German pocket battleship over the Atlantic, and lives to not only file a scoop to New York, but wins the most gorgeous woman in the movie. And I thought, age 12, this sounds like I wouldn't mind having this life. Of course, it didn't actually turn out to be quite like that, but the fact of the matter is that this was the film that made me believe that to be a foreign correspondent would be a very adventurous and exciting life. I didn't realize it could be such a depressing or dangerous life. In movies, of course, the hero always lives. Mm-hmm. I think one of the tragic things about journalism is a lot of my colleagues have died because they arrived in wars with no experience except Hollywood mm-hmm. and thought the hero would live. And of course, that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. But that was a film that struck me. And after that, my father wanted me to be a doctor, he wanted me to be a lawyer, one of the professions. And in despair one afternoon, he invited one of those fake uncles we always have, a family friend who was called Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom arrived and said, well, I'll ask. There are a lot of fake uncles around. He said, Robert, if you were in a law court and you saw the lawyer making his case before the judge and you saw the reporter in his green eye shade, which you would you want to be? And I said, the reporter, there's no doubt. I was about 14. And he turned to my father and said, well, your son is going to be a journalist.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of education did you pursue before you hit the ground running?
Unfortunately, it's not that simple. I went to English public school, which in England means private school, mm-hmm. of course, which was brilliant at teaching Latin, extremely brutal. I got beaten for reading a book on Czech history at a football match, Czech history being much more interesting than English football. I went to my first university. I did my BA in Latin and linguistics at the University of Lancaster in the north of England. I'd already started working, because I didn't think I was going to get a university place, on a local paper in Newcastle upon Tyne, which was a tough, drunken seaport coal mining area in the northeast of England. I then started working on, after my degree, on the Sunday Express in London, running the diary column, where I was chasing Lord Mayors who'd run off with starlets. it wasn't bad. It was good training for covering the Middle East and asking nasty questions of politicians, American and British. And actually, I then joined the Times, went to Northern Ireland, the London Times, before Murdoch took it over and destroyed its integrity. And I went to Northern Ireland for 4 or 5 years as a correspondent. My first conflict. Mm-hmm. A real one, but nothing compared to the colossal bloodbaths I've covered and witnessed in Bosnia, Algeria, Middle East. There was a stoppage on the Times for a year, trade union management stoppage, during which time I actually started doing and completed a PhD at Trinity College, University of Dublin. And that PhD was it was actually politics, but it was political science. But the subject was Irish neutrality in the Second World War, which enabled me to go through a lot of German-British World War II papers, which once again renewed my interest in that. And at the same time gave me a very critical historical background for the Middle East, because, of course, so much of Middle Eastern history that I'm watching results as a direct result of my father's First World War, Treaty of Versailles, and the Second World War, the Jewish Holocaust, the creation of the State of Israel. So in a way, these university education plus my father's memories and upbringing gave me a quite horrifying view of the 20th century, in which, of course, I was born in the first half of the 20th century. I'd have to add that my father was born in 1899, so I can say that my father was born in the century before last. And there's not many six-year-olds can say that, by the way. But anyway, I think there was this sort of combination came together, so that back in the Middle East, I'd already been in the Middle East before I did my PhD, I suddenly found that I had this kind of literary historical interest that was locked into me. My PhD became a best-selling book in Ireland on Irish history, and it's still read in schools. So, and in fact, I still lecture in Ireland on modern Irish history as Dr. Fisk, the academic, not Robert Fisk, the foreign correspondent. And for that reason, I think I began to see more in my work than I'd ever seen before. I don't mean in what I was writing, but what I was witnessing and seeing. And as the years went by and I switched to The Independent from The Times, The Independent had just begun, which is a bright new left-of-centre paper. And a paper which, very fortunately for me, as an editor, and always had editors who believe that they should print what the journalist writes, not what the owner wants. The owner wants the journalist to write what he wants too, which is a wonderful sort of magical situation. Let us hope it always remains that way. But that's basically what happened. That was my upbringing and entry into journalism, and that, unlike most correspondents, I had the good fortune, or immense misfortune, depending on your point of view, to stay in the same area doing the same job. In British newspapers, we don't have this American tradition of sending a reporter there for 3 years, and then just when he's begun to get the contacts and understand the language and the history, they move him somewhere else, so he has to start all over again. I'm against this system. I think it allows you to know everything about nothing and nothing about everything. And to smear journalists with the old line, oh, he's gone native is rubbish. You don't go native in a war zone. It's far too dangerous. So I've ended up, and I'm still, and I'm more just over 30 years, actually, based in Beirut.
I think it would be interesting for our audience, which is both the public and students, to kind of...
They're the same thing, aren't they?
Yes.
You're making this very snobby academic thing about how the students are a little bit different to, quote, ordinary members of the public?
No, I actually was trying to say that the interview is actually used for courses, but that in fact both the undergraduates and the public need things explained in ways that academics often don't do.
We call them readers.
Yeah. but readers, academics use jargon that
unfortunately do.
And so the purpose here is to meet these dual needs.
Anthropologists use this sick language to exclude people from their discourse, as they call it. Yeah. I've written about them, actually. It's from Beirut.
I should say to our audience, and I like to show the book. Chalmers Johnson once criticized me for not showing the book enough. I want to show your book again. Your book is beautifully written. You could be a novelist, but you're actually on the ground. So I think it's important for our audience to explore, you know, what's involved in doing what you do.
It's full of footnotes and references.
Right.
And bibliography.
Yeah.
It's fully academically referenced.
Yes. But I'm not being critical. Mm. So I guess I want to ask you, what are the skills required, do you think, to do what you do, if somebody wants to imitate what you do?
First of all, don't try to do what I do, because it's a dangerous, lonely life, unless you really want to. And it can be a very depressing life, believe me. There was a former Sunday Times Middle East correspondent who tragically died in the 1973 war. He was killed on front line on Golan. And he once wrote, with bitter irony and great humor, that all you need to be as a foreign correspondent is have a few facts, a passable knowledge of English, and rat-like cunning. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, and it's one of the reasons I laugh always at this, it has a good deal of truth in it. I think what you have to do, and it's something that my editors have let me do, and if they didn't, I wouldn't work for them, is you've got to feel passion. Mm-hmm. You've got to read. Read War and Peace. It's an extraordinary book about the reality of war. I remember in Sarajevo being with a Russian soldier who was in the UN force, under fire with him, shells were falling around us, and we were discussing Tolstoy's description of the Battle of Borodino and how it was exactly the same as what we're in now. Mm-hmm. You've got to read Anna Karenina about lost love and betrayal. You've got to read novels about the First World War. You've got to read World War I poetry. Be fascinated, always carry history books in your back pocket. I mean, I read and read all day, sometimes 18 hours a day. I work sometimes 25-hour days. Mm-hmm. Hard work being a foreign correspondent. But I think you've got to be able to write with passion. And you've got to have the freedom to write angrily and to point out the bad guys. If I see a massacre, I don't hesitate to say who's done it and why I think they did it. And my editor, Simon Kellner, who's my editor now at The Independent, he describes our newspaper as a viewspaper. And he wants his correspondents out there on the front line saying what it's like and saying who the bad guys are. And usually it turns out they're all bad. Mm-hmm. Maybe the reporter is too, but certainly most of the... You know, I remember once Ed Cody of the Washington Post, who was then on the AP, still working in Peking for the Post now. He was taking me around Lebanon for my first battle in the Civil War in 1976. And he said, Bob, a lot of people will tell you the Israelis are right, or the Syrians are right, or Palestinians are right, or the Christians are right, or the Muslims are right in Lebanon. He said, believe me, they're all bastards. <You know? laughs> And of course, you can take lots of issues with that, but what he was trying to say was, there's no good guys in war. Mm-hmm. And he's right, there aren't.
Yeah.
You know, all this stuff. Movies give you the idea that war is about victory and defeat, heroism and cowardice. Yeah. It's not. War is primarily about the total failure of the human spirit. It's about death and the infliction of death. Mm-hmm. And if you don't realize that, you'll die in a war. You really will. Forget Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that really stands out in your work is that you go to places where few people dare to go, and you listen, and you see, and then you write.
That's the excitement of journalism and writing. Yeah. That's the excitement of watching history as it happens. If you're going to spend your time at presidential press conferences, off-the-record briefings with embassies, ambassadors, defense attaches, write worthy analysis, calling up hopelessly boring people in what I call think tanks in Washington or New York or London. Why be a journalist? You can live in County Mayo or Denver and do that. You don't, with a mobile phone and internet, which I don't use actually, but that's a different matter. You don't need to go on the thing. It seems to me that our only role at the moment is to be out there on the street, in the battlefield, with soldiers, with civilians, in hospitals particularly, and record the suffering of ordinary people and talk to them. I find A colleague of mine, Australian, came back from southern Lebanon the other day, very moved. She said people had just lost their daughter who died in a cluster bomb left over from the Israeli invasion. And she said they were people who spoke with such nobility. You know, mm-hmm. And I see a lot of nobility in ordinary people. Mm-hmm. I'm not really interested. I mean, I'm interested in why people go to war, why Bush went to war. Before the Iraq War, because I travel the States a lot to give lectures, actually I was at Harvard on September 12 when Bush gave his General Assembly lecture on the worthlessness mm-hmm. of the United Nations. I didn't believe there was going to be an invasion of Iraq. I couldn't believe mm-hmm. it. My editor didn't believe it, but my foreign editor did. And I went down to the United Nations. I'm accredited to the UN. So I went and I sat very close to Bush. I'd never seen him in the flesh before. Mm-hmm. TV gives this flat, bland impression. And I saw Bush, and there was a kind of... I remember what the Iranians always referred to, and I never believed, understood it. The Iranians always talked about the arrogance of power. The people of the United States, of America, they always looked from side to side. It was two Qs, of course. And I realized, he's going to go to war. He's going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I walked out of the General Assembly and called up, you know, bell telephone through the line. I said, Leonard, I'm sorry, I was wrong. There's going to be a war. Mm-hmm. Then by pure chance, I was back in the States lecturing on the East Coast when Colin Powell made his famous February 5th statement in the Security Council. So I went down to the UN again in New York, back this time into the Security Council. And again, astonishing, there was Tenet sitting, like Ernest Borgnine, you know, the old black and white actor behind Colin
Peter
Powell.
Peter Lorre? No, Ernest Borgnine.
Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah, okay.
Gangster with a cigar, yeah, right? Yeah. And he does look a bit like Borgnine, actually, mm-hmm. Tenet. And from the corner, you didn't see this on television, in came little Jack Straw, our foreign secretary, mm-hmm. in a massive power suit. Mm-hmm. And he looked around, caught sight of Colin Powell, and ran with his little feet, got his big American hug. You know, it told you a lot about power and how, and why Blair does what Bush wants. You know, mm-hmm. And then Colin Powell started producing this. You know, again, you have to be there on the scene. Mm-hmm. Watching on television was not good enough. Yeah. And the first thing that they showed up was this big artist's impression. Colin Powell told us that the Iraqis were now using mobile chemical weapons laboratories. Quite difficult with the test tube on the train, right? And it was a picture of a train with a cross section and a scientist in a long white coat holding a test tube, of course, right? And this was supposed to be the mobile weapons lab. You see, and I looked at this and I thought, hang on a minute. Whoever drew this in the State Department or the Pentagon has never been on Iraqi state railways. They come off the track all the time with sanctions. The railway line is no good. You couldn't possibly have a... Even the basic system was wrong. And then they had some quotes from a Republican guard allegedly talking to another on a phone intercept in which one said, whatever you do, don't let them see this. And the reply was, consider it done, sir. Now, nobody actually gave us the Arabic of this, which I would love to have read. Yeah. But I just watched this and I said, this is... Forgive me, the stuff that comes mm-hmm. at the rear end of a ball, this is rubbish. Yeah. It's rubbish. And I wrote the next day that the New York Times will take this in its usual sober way. And sure enough, it did, with Judith Miller beside it on mm-hmm. weapons of mass destruction. American journalism. But you had to be there to have the confidence to say it's not right. Mm-hmm. And to analyze it with being there, you know, a few meters from Powell, mm-hmm. rather than just sitting in London and watching it on a satellite, or sitting in Beirut and watching it on satellite TV. Yeah. So it's being there is what is important. If I can't be there, I don't want to be a journalist anymore.
This, as you describe your work, and you're doing it so well, it strikes me that it's time to ask you about the American awful way of saying it is mission statement. But let's say as a journalist, and
I hate mission statement.
Okay, but what is your goal in what you do? Because I think it's about critiquing power on the one hand, which you've just done, but it's also about, I think from what you just said, empathy with the people who are really suffering
I
the
tell
consequences.
You, I go into a hospital or a ruined building in Lebanon and I see children with their hands chopped off and I see things that would make you puke every morning. And then I sit in Beirut and I turn on my television and I see our own dear Lord Blair of Kut al-Amara, as I call him. Well, we can only absolutely have a ceasefire when we're sure that that ceasefire will hold, and I know he's lying. What he means is that Bush doesn't want a ceasefire yet because he wants the Israelis to have more time to beat the Hezbollah. Therefore, more children are going to be shrieking in hospitals. But they don't care about that. Their experience of war is television. There isn't a single Western cabinet minister anywhere in the Western Hemisphere or the Western world that's ever experienced war now. Mm-hmm. Amazing. When I grew up, we had on the Prime Ministership of England, Eden, Churchill, Attlee, they'd been in the First and Second World Wars. Mm-hmm. When I first worked in Northern Ireland, the first Secretary of State was William Whitelaw, who'd been in the crossing of the Rhine, invasion of Germany, 44-45. Our leaders now just take it all off Hollywood. Bring them on, wasn't it, Bush said. But he get this. Where was this from? Which movie?
It's our leaders who are that way, but it's also our soldiers, because they're playing computer games before they go to war.
Yeah, but once they're in the war, I can tell you that they play the computer games with a different framework of mind. Yeah. I talked to American troops in Iraq. I mean, I talked to French troops in southern Lebanon. I talked to soldiers as well. But again, yes, it's seeing this suffering on this scale. And sometimes, you know, the family are standing by the bed of a dying child and they round on me, you know, how they know who I am, they don't care. You know, I got beaten up by a gang of Afghans in a village just after 2001, 9/11, on the border. Their families had all been killed in B-52 strikes. Mm-hmm. And they attacked me with stones and banging rocks into my face. It was very bad. I was very close to being killed. And I wrote in the paper, you know, if my family had been killed by B-52 and I was an Afghan, I'd probably do the same to Robert Fisk. Doesn't forgive them or excuse them, but I understand it, you know. Mm-hmm. And you see this terrible suffering, this monumental crimes against humanity. Let's speak frankly, that's what we are talking about. We've all committed them, not just Al-Qaeda. We all committed crimes against humanity. I think that if you don't report it, people won't know. I mean, I always say in a rather arrogant way, as I think I've come to realize, that we can tell you what's happening. Don't ever say no one told you. Don't say you didn't know. Mm-hmm. Add to that, and this is in the book, and I know you've interviewed her, Amira Haas, mm-hmm. the very fine Israeli journalist's view on what our job is, or should be, it isn't necessary, a foreign correspondent, that our job is to monitor the centers of power, to challenge authority all the time, especially when they go to war mm-hmm. and they're going to kill people and lie about it. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is that we largely don't do that. Mm-hmm. You only had to watch the press conferences. You know, Mr. President, Mr. President. Yes, Bob. Yes, mm-hmm. Judy. Yes, John. You know, this osmotic, parasitic relationship between journalism and power, particularly in the United States, mm-hmm. but it implies in Europe and especially in Britain and Europe, is very painful to watch because the questions are like, can you give us some more information, General, about how many of your men were involved, rather than, can you explain why three children have been brought in dead and we've seen the videotape mm-hmm. and your men were there? You know, the hugging close to power. You watch American television, the State Department correspondent, the White House correspondent, the Pentagon correspondent, they're basically spokesmen or spokespersons, as you'd like to call them, spokeswomen. They're no more journalists than the official spokesman for the State Department or the President or the White House. This glomming across of journalism into power, I saw it very clearly, actually, in 1990 when American troops were gathering in Saudi Arabia for the first Gulf War, to liberate Kuwait from Saddam. And the funny thing was, lots and lots of journalists were turning up, especially from America, Midwest guys who'd never been abroad before, in military costume. One guy turned up from actually Denver, wearing shoes with camouflaged leaves on. Camouflage with leaves. No, seriously, I mean, if you've seen a desert, and even in a picture, you'll know that there aren't an awful lot of trees, you know, there. But the funny thing was, too, that, you know, I'd go out in the desert, and, you know, I wasn't embedded at all. I'd just drive up to American troops or British troops, and they'd talk to me because they were lonely, mm-hmm. and they were tired, and they were wet, and they had food poisoning all the time. I always bring piles of newspapers to give them, and packets of cigarettes, and, you know. And they'd talk, and they were all writing. They were trying to write poetry. Mm-hmm. One guy in an Abrams tank had worked out a huge board game about flying between planets mm-hmm. and knowing when they could refuel their spaceship. It was, of course, about being a tank crewman in a desert, not knowing if he'd get his resupply of fuel, mm-hmm. as I quickly realized. And these were quite literary people. Yeah. A British guy was trying to write poetry. It wasn't very good, but he was trying. And it suddenly dawned on me that all the soldiers wanted to be journalists, and all the journalists wanted to be soldiers. There's something there which was very dangerous getting loose.
In looking at your career as it has evolved over the 30 years and covering all these wars, talk a little about how the work has changed you. Did your writing become better? Was there one
particular? Yes, it became better. It got better.
Was it the commitment to what you were doing that, and you had so much to tell and working long hours?
No, it was because what I was seeing was so terrible that it gave me an absolute determination to write more freely, mm-hmm. to tell it how it is in the best tradition of American journalism, mm-hmm. as opposed to the worst traditions which we see now. You know, I was thinking the other day, actually, as I was flying here from Beirut a couple of days ago, I was thinking of something Seymour Hersh told me. I like her. She's a mate of mine. We don't see much of each other. We talk on the phone occasionally. Mm-hmm. I've met him, of course. And he said, you know, there's no kudos in American newspapers these days of breaking a big story that's going to be controversial. They want safe journalism. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I was a street reporter in Chicago, he said. And I started off as a street reporter in Newcastle upon Tyne. I understand exactly what he meant. And I think that's a problem an awful lot of journalism in the East Coast of America now. You know, it's graduate school journalism, maybe degrees in journalism, which don't count. I mean, degree in English history or politics, yes, but not journalism. And, you know, I was very struck by this, the fact that reporters are supposed to be obedient now. Look at the reporting of the West Bank, you know, where you journalists, American journalists, keep referring to occupied territory as disputed territory, where the wall is called a fence, where a colony is called a settlement or a neighborhood, you know, or an outpost, where constantly the de-semanticizing of war to make it safe journalism so you won't be called controversial. Heaven spare you if someone falsely accuses you of being anti-Semitic. And this kind of journalism breeds its own sort of internal laziness, you know. And it's also very lethal because if a public is presented with a picture of the Middle East in which there are fences and disputes, a fence like the bottom of your garden, a dispute which you can serve over a glass of water, a cup of tea in a court case, then the use of violence becomes generically violent. It becomes mindless, and thus the Palestinians, for example, who may throw stones or whatever, become people of generically violent, generically violent people. When in fact, if there are walls and if there are people occupying your own land and keeping it, I'm against all violence for all reasons or whatever, but at least you can understand what it means. So we de-semanticize and make war more lethal in the same way as television, for example, will not show you the worst scenes that we see. I remember once a crew coming back from Basra in the Iraqi-American war, not embedded, I mean they were in the Iraqi side of the line. And they came back to Baghdad with terrible pictures. A kid with its hand blown off, a woman shrieking with shrapnel sticking out of her stomach. And they sent these pictures across to London, to the Reuters Bureau in London. And I remember this haughty voice coming back. We can't show these pictures. Don't even bother to send any more. You know, we're going to have people puking at breakfast time. This is pornography, you see. And then the worst quote of all, he said, and I remember his words. I read about it from Baghdad during the war. He said, you know, we've got to show respect for the dead. And I thought, you bloody well don't show any respect for them when they're alive, but when they're in bits, we've got to respect their bodies. Heaven spare me. You know, I always say to people on the road near Basra in 91, I saw women as well as soldiers and civilians, old men, being torn apart by British bombs, actually, as well as Americans. And dogs were tearing them to pieces to eat. It was lunchtime in the desert. I tell you, if you saw what I saw, you'd never support a war again. But you won't show that on television. And by not showing that on television, we present the world with a bloodless sandpit. We pretend war is not that bad. It's surgical. Always surgical strikes. Surgery is a place where you're cured in hospital, not where you're murdered or killed or torn apart. Right? And thus we make it easier for our leaders, our generals, our prime ministers, our presidents, to sell us war and for us to buy into war and go along with it. And that makes us lethally culpable and potentially war criminals in a very moral sense of the word. Immoral sense, I should say.
So this lack of vision about war, what war is really about, is conducive to the changes in military strategy, which says, well, we can do it all by computer. We can go into a place like Iraq, you know, and bomb the place and then leave immediately. So there's a kind of a fit between what's happening in the culture and the kind of war American leaders at least want to wage.
Yeah, I mean, the culture of journalism in war hasn't changed an awful lot. I mean, reporters during World War II, I mean, with Western armies, were pretty much on side, and why not? We all knew, I wasn't alive, and so we all knew that Hitler's was an evil, wicked, terrible regime. But they were able to tell quite a lot about the blood and the splintered bones and the civilians. It got out, just as, of course, the concentration camps, the extermination camps when they liberated, rightly got out. But pictures, you see, film cameras were not the same then. Vietnam was undoubtedly a turning point. You did see a lot of blood and gore in Vietnam. Not as much as there was, but you saw quite a lot.
And it became a political problem for the...
Exactly. Yeah. And rightly so. The problem now is that, at the end of the day, television will not push any limits. We've got to have access. We've got to have pictures. And at the end of the day, every time television journalists, crews, companies have been confronted by the military saying, you may not, you will not. They said, we got to, we'll get a high court writ, we'll go to court of freedom. And they cave in and they do what the military want. And the military know they're going to do what they want. At the moment, it's almost impossible to travel anywhere in Iraq. And the American military is very happy with that. We can't investigate the bombing of villages. We can't go to Helmand province in Afghanistan because we'd be killed. My colleague Patrick Coburn of The Independent wrote a very finely written piece in the paper, my paper the other day, The Independent. He said, you know, the worst thing about listening to Tony Blair say that things are getting better in Iraq is that if we went there where we could prove him wrong, we would have our throats cut because it's getting worse, you see. But he can say, because we don't go there, it's getting better, see?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah. I think that the culture of not covering war correctly has gone right along, but you'll always find a way around it if you want to. If you want to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a camera. Well, I carry a still pitch camera. Mm-hmm. I still use real film, by the way. I'm not digitalized yet.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, I don't use email or the internet. But I can wangle my way and talk my way, and I know enough people in that region to get where I want to get.
Mm-hmm. Is looking at your extraordinary career, I want you to look back at it.
It isn't extraordinary, actually. It's a pretty depressing career.
Well, it's extraordinary in comparison to what many reporters cover these situations, if they cover them at all. But I'm curious, was there one event, one war, one incident, one village destroyed, where you did a second take and it brought you to a new level of understanding war?
Yes.
Yeah, and what was that?
The massacre at Sabra Shatila,
okay,
from September 16th to 18th, 1982, when Israel's phalangist Christian Lebanese allies were sent into the camp and massacred up to 1,700 Palestinians. I got into the camp with an American and Norwegian colleague, and the murderers were still in the camp. You still hear the shooting. And we found piles of bodies. We had to climb over them on our hands and knees, corpses rotting in the sun.
And we should explain to our audience that this was the Israelis allowing the Christian Lebanese...
No, they sent the Christian Lebanese militias into the camp. They sent them in to destroy Palestinian terrorists.
Yeah, okay.
There weren't any armed men in the camp, of course. And what was terrible about it, as the Israelis later disclosed in their official account, is that the Israelis watched this happen and did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very struck by this, because when I was in the camp, I could see the Israelis watching and doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They saw and they did nothing. And I remember once I ran with my American colleague. We heard the murderers coming down the street. And we ran into the back of this house, this backyard of this house, and closed the door gently and waited, hoping they wouldn't find us, because we thought they're just going to kill us too. We're witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked down on the left-hand side of my eye, and I saw this young woman lying on her back with her head up towards the sun, her hands spread out, with a halo of clothes pegs around her head. She'd been putting out the washing.
Mm-hmm.
And from behind her back was running this ant's track of blood across the yard. She'd just been murdered. As we came through the backyard, the murderers were obviously leaving through the front door.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching this woman, thinking she will get up. She'll get up and say, I've got a pain in my back. She was dead, of course. And I remember that night, I went back to the AP bureau. In those days we had telexes, old machines with tapes you had to file a story out of. And it was a Saturday and we didn't have a Sunday paper on the Times then. I didn't have to file till the next day, and I sat there in absolute distraction that this had happened. I'd never seen killing on this scale, this cruelly, watched by a civilized army. And I wrote that night with a freedom of anger and passion I'd never felt before, because you were victims on a massive scale.
Mm-hmm.
A very fine Israeli writer later compared it to the Ustashi killings in Bosnia in the Second World War, which the Germans watched. That wasn't saying the Israelis were Germans, which is rubbish, they're not, but that's what he compared it to.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching in the AP bureau as phone calls came in from New York, well, can you really call this a massacre? I remember saying to the editor of AP, I was working from his bureau, I said, when is a massacre war against humanity, crime against humanity? And when does an atrocity make a massacre? Are you really getting involved in this? Haven't you seen the pictures?
Mm-hmm.
And the picture editor of AP was saying, I can't believe this. You know, this is war crime. A war crime is producing like dirty pictures out of an envelope, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember discussing afterwards, particularly with American television reporters. They were using first videotape then, of course, footage. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult. They had to take the videotape to Damascus, have it satellite up to them. It wasn't just having a little machine in those days. And we all agreed that we now had a freedom to speak about the Middle East wars and to speak about Israel, which we never had before. Mm. Later, of course, a new generation of journalists came, and many of them went back to reporting things the old way, where you had to talk about, you know, disputed instead of occupied, and fences instead of walls or whatever. But that's what changed me after that. I remember distinctly people telling me, my mother, who was still alive then, my father and mother are dead now, that you really write quite differently now. And quite a lot of my colleagues did too. Mm-hmm. David Hurst of The Guardian, I noticed the way his writing changed and became harsher, mm-hmm. and became much more passionate and intense. And I believe journalists should be. This business where, oh, we've got to give 50% of the story to one side and 50% to the other in order to be, quote, impartial, absolute rubbish. We should be partial. We should say who the bad guys are. We should denounce the Syrians when they commit murder in Hama, and the Iraqis when they gas people, and the Israelis when they massacre refugees on the roads of southern Lebanon. You know, if we were covering the slave trade, would we give equal time to the slave ship captain? No, we'd talk to the slaves, wouldn't we? Mm-hmm. If we were present at the liberation of a Nazi extermination camp, do we give equal time to the spokesman for the SS? Mm-hmm. Forget it. We talk to the survivors and talk about the victims. When I was in Jerusalem in August of 2001, that's when a Palestinian suicide bomber blew up a pizzeria full of women and children. I went and wrote about the children I saw dead in front of me, Israeli children, of course. I didn't give half my story to the Islamic Jihad spokesman, you know. Mm-hmm. Same at Sabra Shatila, I didn't write about the IDF, I wrote about the victims. Mm-hmm. So we should have a side, it should be a moral side to us. Okay, we may get it wrong occasionally, but if we're not going to write like that, what the hell's the point of being there and taking the risk and sending a correspondent all over the world? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'll give you my perfect example of what's wrong with journalism at the moment, the degree to be safe and quote someone else. Patrick Coburn, my colleague again, was in Baghdad, and he was on the balcony of his room, and there were bullets flying around outside. There are all the time now. It's a hell disaster. And he saw an American colleague crawling out on his balcony, putting up his sat phone and talking on it. And he thought, my God, there must be an exclusive story to take that kind of risk, you see. And a guy came back in the room later that evening. He said, by the way, that was very courageous of you to take that risk. What the hell were you filing? He said, oh, no, he said, I was ringing the Brookings Institute. I needed a quote about what was happening in Iraq. That's what's wrong with American journalism. That's what's wrong with American journalism. Yeah. That's what's wrong with journalism, full stop. Actually, I should say, you know, we're talking about other journalists. The French are very good at getting to the scene and reporting the reality. Mm-hmm. I know France doesn't have a very clean reputation in American politics at the moment, but by goodness, they've got good journalists. You read a translation of Libération, Figaro, Le Monde. They've got. I work a lot with French. I normally work on my own, but if I work with other reporters, I tend to work with the Italians or the French because, my goodness, they get to the war front. Mm-hmm.
Your book begins with your three interviews with Osama bin Laden.
I'm going to have to live with this guy, Osama bin Laden, for the rest of my life. I know that, yeah.
But I guess, you know, there's a lot in them and so on, but I would just like for you to, looking back, to comment on those interviews, because as I read them in the book, I think they awakened you to what was coming, though you didn't know what
I don't think they awakened me as much as I think they do now, or did. You can look back in the reflection of what you know later happened. For example, in the interview, the last interview I did with him prior to 9/11.
These would have been in the 90s, basically.
That's correct.
One in the Sudan, two.
He wanted to see me in Afghanistan after 9/11, and I tried to get to him.
Yeah.
But the Taliban people who were taking me were frightened of the bombs in front of us. The Americans were bombing. The Taliban, who's supposed to go to heaven if they die as martyrs, didn't want to die. And I was saying, but we've got to get to Bin Laden.
I see.
I was the one who was showing what they were supposed to demonstrate. But anyway, we didn't make it. So, yes, it was 97. And he said to me, we were on the top of a mountain in one of his training camps, built originally, of course, by the CIA when fighting the Russians. And he said, Mr. Robert, from this mountain upon which you're sitting, we destroyed the Soviet army and the Soviet Union. We destroyed the Russians. Which was a hell of an exaggeration, but had a certain truth to it. It was the destruction of the Soviet army in Afghanistan that led to the fall of the Soviet Union, and, you know, free Russia. Ever more quotes around the word free at the moment. And then he said, and I pray to God that he permits us to turn America into a shadow of itself. I remember the pictures of the Twin Towers falling. Mm-hmm. Manhattan was a shadow of itself. Mm-hmm. And in the margin, when I got the notebooks to write this book, I found I'd written, the actual notebook I had opposite Bin Laden, I'd written, rhetoric, ? Well, yes, hollow laughter. Yeah. Certainly, I've gone back, and I went again recently through my notes. I've kept everything. I've got 328,000 pictures, files, photographs, tapes, notes, mm-hmm. books, clippings, photocopies. And I find that several times before 9/11, I wrote in The Independent, on one occasion, quite brought a stop to a television program in CBC in Toronto, Canadian Broadcasting, by saying, talking about the explosion to come. Mm-hmm. I made a movie on real film for cinema, but also for Channel 4 and Discovery Channel in 1993, in which I actually walk into a burning mosque in Bosnia. And my words on the soundtrack were, when I see things like this, I remember the place where I worked, the Middle East. When violence is committed there, we call it mindless terrorism. Mm-hmm. But when I see things like this, I wonder what the Muslim world has in store for us. Maybe I should end each of my reports with the words, watch out. Mm-hmm. And for this book, I went back through all the clips. We still have the celluloid film clips. And we went into that mosque on September the 11th, 1993. Mm-hmm. Oh, 8 years too early, but yeah, we got it right.
Yeah, yeah.
The New York Times condemned this series, by the way, as being sensationalist.
Mm-hmm.
Ouch.
Mm-hmm.
So, you didn't have to meet bin Laden if you lived in the Middle East, mm-hmm. and you spent your time with ordinary people, not with embassy officials, mm-hmm. and you knew something was coming. You knew something was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to happen again. It's going to happen again.
I have a trick question for you, and that is since
we do the trick questions on you, don't we?
Yeah, no. But I guess the question is this, because if you, as I just go through your book, I mean, two figures stand out, Sharon and Osama bin Laden, and they stand out.
No, my father stands out. My father's all the way through the book.
Yeah, I didn't realize it, but he is. I'm sorry. I want to put...
He's not quite as bad as
These are two men who've really shaped this history in the time that you're writing. And I'm curious, how would you compare them? Because both have done really awful things.
I would say that Arafat is in there very strongly. Arafat comes over very, very badly in my book.
Yeah. So what is about...
Arafat comes over as an extremely corrupt person, painted worse than Saddam Hussein, although Saddam comes over very badly as well. I find all these people very sinister.
That's what I want. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Sinister.
And
of course, there's no point in avoiding the fact that when you meet a sinister person, you want to get out your screwdriver and unplug the computer and find out what happens inside it, And I think it comes down to a question of, can you use words like evil and wicked?
Mm-hmm.
I've met people in the Lebanese Civil War, ordinary gunmen, who get drugged up, who enjoy torture,
mm-hmm.
who've raped and enjoyed it. And they're bad people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're reformable.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, after the war, I've seen them again, met their little children, who've played with my pussycat mm-hmm. on my balcony.
Mm-hmm.
You have to admit their humanity, even though they have none.
Mm-hmm.
I find that the greatest sin of people, over and above their individual crimes, is their absolute self-conviction. Sharon has it, if he's still with us. You couldn't possibly... I mean, when I talked with bin Laden, I tried constantly to debate with him. You can debate with the Hezbollah leadership. You can debate with Nasrallah or Fadlallah or any of these people. Actually, you could debate with Saddam, oddly enough. Not with Arafat. Arafat had complete suffrage. Bin Laden, you couldn't have a serious discussion with. He knew what was right, and he knew he was right. And I have to say, sometimes reading through all my notes of my meetings, there were some parallels with George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Right and wrong. Them or us. They hate us because of our values, our democracy. In a sort of mirror, faint, parallel, horrific way, it does reflect the kind of language of Osama bin Laden, who is equally absolutely adamant. But in bin Laden's case, he doesn't have a people who can diselect him, and there isn't a stop-off point after the second run.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about the sense of history which you got from your father. You, just to quote you here, you say, after the Allied victory of 1918, at the end of my father's war, the victory divided up the lands of their former enemies. In the space of just 17 months, they created the borders of Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, most of the Middle East. And I have spent my entire career in Belfast, in Sarajevo, in Beirut, in Baghdad, watching the people within those borders burn. And so my question is, where do you find these people you've just described, the Bin Ladens, you know, make muck, essentially, in this world? So where is, or do you find...
They're our creatures. We created them.
Right. But then where do you find the good? Is it in the little people who you listen to, who you watch suffer?
It's in those people who lost their daughter who showed so much nobility. Okay. It's in the family under fire in their home, under Israeli artillery fire, who run into the road and grab me and pull me into their sitting room so I can lie on the floor with them and avoid being killed. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. And they're not my religion. Well, I don't know if I have a religion, but I'm certainly not theirs.
Yeah.
You know, I'm living among a people who've maintained their faith when we Westerners have not. Mm-hmm. The fact is we've lost it. Mm-hmm. That's the famous Arnold poem, The Sea's Long Withdrawing Roar, the Victorian poem about the loss of faith. We don't appreciate these things. We don't read history. They do. They remember it very clearly. I think the good is only in those little people. You know, I'm always aroused to anger by hearing journalists talking about the effect of war on them. You know, can they cope? How do they come to terms with it? Do they need counseling? Mm-hmm. I think this is nonsense. The only people who matter are the people who can't leave the country. We can get a plane out, club class, and have a glass of champagne. These people have pariah passports. They have to live and die there with their families. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are good people. They don't deserve what's happening to them. I mean, I must admit, when I finished writing this, I was overwhelmed by the conviction of how... I was amazed at the restraint that Muslims have shown towards us over the last mm-hmm. 90 years. Amazed that we haven't had more 9/11s. Mm-hmm. But we will have more again. I mean, I'm sure it'll happen in London again. You know, the days when we could go abroad and have foreign adventures, Korean War, Vietnamese War, and no Viet Cong ever came to Washington, blew up the State Department, no North Korean ever turned up on the London tubes, they're gone forever. The new strategy of war is that we are not going to be safe in San Diego or mm-hmm. Colorado, Gloucestershire, northern mm-hmm. France, Berkeley. Mm-hmm. We're not safe anymore, and we have to accept that. If we're going to have these foreign adventures, if this is going to be our ideological future, mm-hmm. You know, remember, Bush at one point said that the war on terror may last forever, eternal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is this? Nightmares to frighten school children. We have to stand up against it. I mean, I keep saying to people, you know, we keep being told 9/11 changed the world forever, and that allows us to have torture chambers and break up mm-hmm. all the rules we set down for human rights after the Second World War. Well, Bush allows that to happen. I will not let 19 Arab murderers change my world. Mm-hmm. Nor should you, mm-hmm. and nor should Bush have allowed them to.
Mm-hmm. I sense when you look at the sweep of this history that we the West, the U.S., are often foisted by our own petard, that our actions...
Cliché.
Yeah, okay.
Cliché.
in the sense that we set in motion. I mean, we had Juan Cole on the program, and I noticed he made the point that you make in your book, that we helped create the Iranian nuclear program under the Shah.
Yeah, of course.
You know, that the Israelis at one time, I think, supported Hamas when they thought they were
absolutely
an alternative. So
talk an opponent to the PLO.
Yeah. And so is this just our fate as mankind?
Look, you know, I think, you know, I'll join those who say it's too simplistic always to blame the West. Mm-hmm. I live among Muslims. My driver's a Muslim. My landlord's a Muslim. My grocer's a mm-hmm. Muslim. You know, I live in the Muslim world. I have to say, I don't consciously think about it, and nor do they with me. Mm-hmm. These are my fellow human beings. These are people I risk my life with. Or they risk their lives with me, or whatever. I don't think about religion. If their relatives die, I go, and of course they have a Muslim funeral, mm-hmm. and I'm there. But I don't think about it. Going to mosque to me doesn't mean anything to me personally, in the sense it doesn't mean I'm moving mm-hmm. across anywhere or moving towards. You know, I think that the problem for us is that we are the most powerful people. Mm-hmm. These are the people who've kept their faith, the Muslims. These are the people who still permit and allow and wish religion to trickle and run like water through their blood mm-hmm. veins and their lives. As we used to, until perhaps the Renaissance in Europe mm-hmm. and afterwards. We can be puritanical in religion. We can be, you know, we can find God, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. But as a civilization in the West, we have lost our faith. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that we who've lost our faith have the power to impose ourselves upon people who have not lost it, while people who have kept the faith do not have the physical military or political power to defend themselves. That is the true nature of when people talk about the War of Civilizations, which is a total cliche and not true. I don't have, I'm not involved in a War of Civilizations. I don't see a War of Civilizations, though again, there are people who would like one. So I think it's really a question of understanding that, you know, sometimes I think the Western world and the Eastern world are very jealous of each other. Mm-hmm. We profess to think that the Muslim world goes wants to return to the Middle Ages. But I find lots of people from the Orientalists onwards are fascinated by men who have four wives. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think that a lot of Westerners would like to have four wives. And they're very jealous they can't, you see. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, and this will sound quite cruel, but at the same time I meet a lot of Arabs who are very interested in the way we have our freedoms, mm-hmm. whether they be social freedoms, sexual freedoms in the West. Sometimes I think they're quite jealous of us for having a freedom socially, which they don't have. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think, rather like the journalists who want to be soldiers and the soldiers who want to be journalists, mm-hmm. the Muslims would like to be the West and vice versa, you know. We do regret, I think, in some ways, that we don't have a faith. Mm-hmm. I remember my father once asking me if I was frightened of dying, and I said, "You bet." He said, "That's because you've lost your faith." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Dad, I never had any." Mm-hmm. Never had any.
Yeah. Now, you know, there are many ways we can critique U.S. policy, but I want to ask about a particular thing which I often read in your former colleague in Lebanon, Tom Friedman's comms.
Tom Friedman, the frontier of permitted criticism of the present regime here,
Where are the moderates in the Islamic world? You know,
every Muslim I meet virtually is a moderate.
No, right, I understand it. So talk a little about that. In other words...
First of all, I should tell you, Tom Friedman is an old friend of mine. I still have dinner with him at DuPont Circle in Washington from time to time. But he really is becoming messianic. He probably wants to be the Secretary of State. And at the moment, I read him because I know it's so outrageous. I will laugh and laugh. Where are the moderates? Look, we're all moderates, if we want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, we divide people up into doves and hawks, more cliches, and moderates and immoderates or whatever, radicals and fanatics, fundamentalists, you name it, antiquistes, the French say. You know, we're all human beings and we have to decide what we want to be. Driven into a corner like animals, the most soft, gentlest, liberal human being will turn into a tiger. You make me angry enough and I'll start screaming in fury at you. You're not a moderate anymore, Bob, you see. You pound and pound and pound a whole people because of their religion, because of their ethnic origin, because they seem to oppose you. And they'll turn on you, yes. And then you'll say they hate us because they don't like our values and our democracy. Mm-hmm. Huh? Where are the moderates in America? Well, half the people who didn't vote for George W. Bush, I'm not even sure that's true. You know, there's a moderate in everybody, but it depends how we frame our lives. I don't think we can chop people up into moderates and immoderates. I notice we don't use that. You notice we don't talk about the Christians. We talk about Muslims and the West, because there aren't many Christians left now, maybe not any. Moderates are people who tend to be without power.
Mm-hmm. Good answer. So has all of this work, all of this, the heavy load of history in this particular place, made you, what view of human nature has it left you with? Has it made you a pessimist about the future?
Yeah.
Why? I mean, well, not why, but...
Well, I suppose, I've had a very distorted view of the world. I remember during the Civil War once in Lebanon, I took the Lebanese aircraft still flew murderously and dangerously out of Beirut, 707s. I took a weekend to Switzerland to go and see a girlfriend of mine, this would be 25 years ago now. And I arrived in Switzerland, which is a country where you can be arrested for throwing a cigarette packet into a roadway. And after 2 weeks of this perfect world, a beautiful fine white wines, the perfect food, a lady on your arm to go down the street with, I remember going back to Beirut and hearing the sort of matchstick crackle of rifle fire and the smell of burning garbage in the street outside and thinking this was the real world. You begin to feel that war is the natural condition of mankind. And that's very dangerous. When I was, there's lots of editions of this in different languages, and I did the French and Dutch edition almost simultaneously more than a year ago. It was a beautiful autumn in Europe, and I was on the boulevards of Paris and the streets of Holland, and I saw lots of families, you know, children, who'd lived in comparative safety and security. I'm sure they have their own problems. And I went back to Beirut, which was going through another of its appalling political crises, and it had some bombardments in the south from the Israelis. And I remember sitting on my balcony looking over the Mediterranean. I got a very nice home in Beirut. And thinking, did I really want to spend these 30 wonderful years of my life the way I did, you know? Couldn't I have been happier? Couldn't I have enjoyed what other people had? My editor, the editor of my book in London, took me out to lunch when the book came out and said, congratulations. I said, why, was it that good? She said, no, you survived. Yeah. And I looked back and I felt very depressed. I really began to wonder whether I'd spent my life wrongly. And then, of course, I went back to remember foreign correspondent and Joel McCrea being sent to Europe. He was a crime correspondent in New York, and his editor has this immortal line, what we need in Europe is a crime correspondent. And I began to wonder whether perhaps I hadn't been a crime correspondent for the past 30 years. And I also went back and remembered Robert Fisk on a beach in Portugal in 1976. I was briefly the Lisbon correspondent after the revolution. Mm-hmm. Getting a phone call, actually a letter from my foreign editor saying, I'm offering you the Middle East. Because our present correspondent there had just got married and his bride didn't want to live. She didn't want to be a widow. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to live in a war. And I realized if I was offered, I'd have the same life again if mm-hmm. I had the chance to run it again.
Mm-hmm. One last question. If students were watching this program, how would you advise them to prepare for their future in which they might be a war correspondent?
Don't be a war correspondent. I tell you, I'll be very frank with you. If you want to be a reporter, you must establish a relationship with an editor in which he will let you write. He must trust you, and you must make sure you make no mistakes. But with humor, you must make sure that what you write is printed as you write it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you will never recover from that. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like being frightened of something. If you lose your fear, you will never have to worry about it again. Mm-hmm. But more important than that, and I get a lot of letters like this from mm-hmm. students. Some of them say to me, well, I can't make up my mind. I would like to be a journalist. Of course, I'd all like to be Middle East correspondent. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'd like to be a lawyer. And I always say, look, if it's a choice between being a doctor or a journalist or a lawyer and a journalist, you've got to be a doctor or a lawyer. Mm-hmm. The only person who can be a journalist has a bug, and journalism is the only thing in the whole world that they can do. If that's you, you will be a journalist.
On that note, Robert Fisk, thank you very much for being here. Let me show your book again. Everybody want it'll take them a while to read it, but it's definitely worth reading. The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. Thank you for this work, your work, and thank you for being here today with us.
Thanks very much indeed.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.